Football Weekly is on the air.
Hi, I'm Hub Arkush, and along with senior editor Mike Wilking and the entire Pro Football Weekly editorial staff, it is our pleasure to bring you this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly, where every week we try and bring you all the news, scoops, and rumors from around the NFL before they've even happened.
We have the latest on NFL CBA talks, plus a look at several teams that could be very busy re-signing their own in free agency.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air!
Hello to one and all, and thank you so much for joining us for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. I am Hub Arkush, the publisher and editor. Going it alone in the studio, but on the hotline, a number of contributors from our editorial staff. Our senior editor, Mike Wilkening, will be with me co-hosting throughout the show. And we are joined in this first segment by executive editor Dan Arkush and associate editor Dan Parr. As we continue what's become protocol the last couple weeks, we're going to spend about 10, 15 minutes getting you up to date on everything going on in the world of NFL labor impasse. It's been a positive week by all accounts, guys. A lot of good feeling out there. People believe that there is cause for optimism, that an agreement is somewhere down the road. I'm not one who believes it's around the corner, but that they're definitely moving in the right direction. Of course, Pro Football Weekly office is located just north of Chicago, and the owners met all 32 on Tuesday of this past week, just west and north of Chicago in Rosemont. Our very own Dan Parr was there. And Dan, the tone coming out of those conversations seeming somewhat conciliatory, somewhat optimistic, and yet continuing to be cautious because, let's be honest, there's still a lot of ground for the owners and the players to cover.
Yeah, it's almost become a challenge of managing expectations as these owners walk out of these meetings because, you know, fans are hungry for this to be settled. The media has kind of sent out signals saying that they're getting closer. They want to kind of throw a little cold water on there. And Bob Kraft, the Patriots, Jim Mercer from the Colts, both as they walked out were a couple of the few owners who actually said anything as they left the building. And their emphasis was that there's a lot of hard work left to do. Roger Goodell said the same thing. Morris Smith in a conference call with players this week has said similar things. They really don't want people to think that this is about to be done, and I think it's because they know that this could break down still.
Well, and Wilkie, I think one of the reasons for that, or at least the most obvious reason for that, the players and owners, both sides have done a really nice job of keeping a gag order on their negotiations as ordered by the federal magistrate, Judge Fred Boylan. But the owners' meetings, the owners can say whatever they want, and they've leaked, as they always do, exactly what they want to leak and made it sound like this is great. We've got a proposal. It's 48% of all revenue. We think the players are going to love it. Well, the fact is the players have already turned down an offer that included 48% of revenue. We don't know what all revenue is. And the bottom line is what the owners left Chicago with was maybe something that they'd be happy with, but something the players haven't even seen yet.
Right. This is a negotiation. You've got to get both sides on board for an agreement. The overriding sense here is there is work to be done, and that getting both sides to meet in the middle is still the goal. And Hub, I think you raise a good point with regards to the gag order and with regards to the type of details in these proposals. We don't know everything that's going into these proposals. We're just getting bits and pieces at this point. And obviously, this is probably the most complex set of negotiations that we've ever seen, given the amount of money at stake and given all the ancillary issues that kind of bubble up from time to time that seem to be real sticking points between both sides.
We'll swing over to Dan Arkush. And Dan, you and I have been through this in 82, a 56-day in-season work stoppage, the replacement games in 87, the malaise that hung over the game from 89 to 92, even though they were playing, but playing without a CBA. As we look at this one, there definitely is a really different dynamic between this players association and these owners. And they did meet face to face on Wednesday and Thursday of this week in Boston. There seemed to be optimism leaking out of the meetings on Wednesday. No real comment after Thursday. They are continuing to talk. And yet, I don't know if you're hearing different what I'm hearing. No real indication from the players yet as to what they think of this new proposal that the owners have put on the table.
That's exactly right, Hub. And based on some reports that I'm hearing to these talks that have been going on in Boston, it appears that they have ended temporarily. And I think we've reached a point now where, you know, they should be pretty much going around the clock. Yeah, I would cut them some slack for the 4th of July holiday, but I think really, you know, at this point, it really has to be a concerted effort with a real sense of urgency, as we've talked before the whole free agent process, is going to need at least, I would think, 2 weeks to get that done. And I'm kind of disappointed that they apparently have stopped for the rest of this week as of this taping.
Yeah, we do know there will be no formal talks over the weekend between the two negotiating teams, although there are suggestions and rumors leaking out that individuals from each side could get together to talk about certain parts of the offer. And Dan Parr, I want to swing it back to you. I think the key right now is that the owners purposely leaked things of their proposal coming out of their meetings. They weren't bound by the gag order, and they want it to sound like they've got something magnanimous the players should accept. The bottom line is the biggest sticking point for 3 years, for 3 months, for 3 weeks, has been the split of revenue, and this 48% of all revenue sounds great, except the owners have pretty much acknowledged that, all revenue, but there's still going to be some credits off the top, not the billion that there was, and so we still don't know how this proposal relates to the proposal that the owners opted out of.
And we also have a pretty clear understanding that when they did meet this week, all owners and team representatives in Chicago, that they didn't really get too far into the details of this thing just yet. The trial balloon was floated that same day, and those numbers that you just spoke of came out. But inside the meeting room, this was a very broad, general type of session where owners were being filled in on what had happened since they all came together before, which is about a month. And Roger Goodell, I think, is making a real effort not to let owners get to a point where they get everything and have to feel like there's a deal that's ready to be done and build up some resentment or build up some sort of sense that this is not a good deal. He wants to keep information, I think, to a certain extent to himself and keep it between the people who are actually at these meetings face-to-face with other player representatives. They're being very careful about managing the information that comes out. But that, like you said, this week, those numbers, we haven't heard a full player reaction to that. They've been much quieter. They have not floated any sort of trial balloon, and they're operating a little differently right now.
All right, guys, there was an 800-pound gorilla in the room in Rosemont with the 32 owners on Tuesday. Nobody's talking about it yet, but we will. Quick commercial break, and we're back with more Pro Football Weekly. Welcome back, folks. So good to have you with us for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. I'm Hub Arkish. I have Mike Wilkening, our senior editor, executive editor Dan Arkish, and associate editor Dan Parr all alongside. We're trying to get you up to speed on the labor impasse. And, guys, it's interesting. If you go back to 2006, people forget that both sides walked away from the table, that deal expired. Gene Upshaw and Paul Tagliabue immediately got together and 48 hours later were able to get a deal through. The reason the owners walked in 06 was the players were insisting on, in addition to sharing all TV revenue and other revenues, about 80% of the total football revenue, they created a second revenue sharing pool in which the 15 highest grossing teams would pay into this pool and the 9 lowest grossing teams would be allowed to draw out of that pool. We have heard no discussion about this whatsoever in the last 3 months, again, 3 years, 2 years, whatever it may be, and I will guarantee you, at least I'm told by a couple of my sources, that it came up in the meeting on Tuesday and was quickly shot down. As Dan was pointing out just before the break, Roger Goodell is trying to make progress here, and so nobody's really talking about it. Not only is there this group of hawks led by Jerry Jones and Jerry Richardson who want the players to accept a lower share of revenue, but they have also been really outspoken about having to support the lower grossing teams who maybe don't work as hard for their money. And Wilkie, I'm going to come to you first because you cover the Bengals, and everybody knows Mike Brown's got one of those teams. And when we talk about work left to be done, they could get everything else done, and this could be the sticking point again.
Right, Hub. It's a good point that you bring up 06. And, yeah, people forget that this was a negotiation that was a difficult one and one that at one point looked like things might kind of fall apart here, that maybe we were going to go into the abyss and have a similar stoppage situation or a prolonged problem like we had this year. I think as it stands, you're right. This is an issue that has to be dealt with in terms of not only the revenue that the league itself generates, but with regards to how or if owners are going to share that revenue and how that works out. And you're right, that was an issue that they were able to bridge in the last agreement, but it took some real teamwork from the owners to get that done. And And you're right, the split between higher revenue owners and lower revenue owners, that gap is not getting any smaller. And you know, obviously there are different groups of owners that have different interests vis-a-vis revenue generation and also what the best way to go about sharing all that revenue is.
Dan Arkish, when we hear about the two AFC owners heading into those meetings last Tuesday who were rumored to be upset with where the deal was at, everybody knew it was Ralph Wilson and Mike Brown, and this is just part of the problem. They need both. They need that revenue sharing pool. They need to get back as much money as they can from the players, and they need the floor on the salary cap to be as low as it possibly can. And another thing that we're hearing about the deal that's on the table is that the owners are offering to actually raise the floor for the players, not lower it, and you just have to wonder if a league that prior to opting out of the current deal with all 32 teams profitable isn't creating a situation where some of their teams are going to struggle to survive.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest problems is what is this ancillary revenue? I mean, it's just such a vague concept, and I just think that really kind of pinpointing the actual dollars and cents is a key part of it. What are they sharing? The other thought I have is the hope that there's just maybe so much new revenue, specifically from this idea, this concept of 16 Thursday night games, those eight new games that the networks will bid for. I mean, hopefully that'll create just such a mountain of money that, you know, that's going to make everybody at least, you know, reasonably happy in the long run.
Let me wrap it with Mr. Parr. Dan, again, you were with the owners in Rosemont this past Tuesday. Did you hear any rumblings from anybody that this second sharing pool of revenue has come up at all, that it could be part of this deal? And do we have any real sense of how different the proposal that the owners have given the players this week is from the offer the players walked away from 2 months ago? Because the reality is, not only the owners strongly incented to make a deal right now, but the appellate court in St. Louis has pretty strongly incented the players, and part of the trick is giving DeMaurice Smith a place to fall.
Yeah, I think that the offer has changed. There's been progress made. The owners did not want to talk about what was discussed inside that meeting room, so the Thursday night package has not been discussed in length with any owner, and there's been not much public comment on that, but I think it's safe to say that that is an idea that does really help move this deal in the right direction. So I think that's progress. There's no doubt about it. Whether it is very serious, whether it's something we can count on, I don't think we're ready to say that yet, but it does seem like something that both sides would kind of use as something to help rally, gain momentum, and bring them closer together. So I think that's a positive step, and we're not there yet, but that is a good sign.
All right, guys, no more meetings until next week. We will bring you up to speed in next week's show. A lot of player conversation this week, then. We've got it all for you in the way we hear it coming up next. We roll on with Pro Football Weekly, and we promise player news. There has been quite a bit of it this week, and actually, you know, guys, I'm still joined by Dan Parr, our associate editor who covers the NFC South for us, and of course Mike Wilkening, senior editor. We're going to talk to Wilkie about a couple of his ball clubs. One thing that to me has been a given from day one: the players are not going to accept an agreement that doesn't give fourth-year veterans unrestricted free agency again. They had it from 06 through 09. It was a poison pill put in 10 to try and avoid what's happening. But the bottom line is they're not going backwards that way. And I think it's pretty much been established that that's what's on the table right now. And with fourth-year veterans unrestricted, it's going to really impact some teams, Dan, especially a couple of years, Carolina Panthers and the Atlanta Falcons. Probably the two key guys the Panthers have to deal with: running back D'Angelo Williams, who I think the Panthers are prepared to move on from, but defensive end Charles Johnson is a key part of Ron Rivera's plans, and now they've got to get him re-signed.
Yeah, these were players they put tenders on, hoping that there would be a stipulation in the new CBA that kept them from becoming unrestricted. So they were prepared for either scenario, but they did have the, you know, hoping that the option would be, let's keep these guys for one more year at a relatively low cost. That would be wiped out if these guys, if the new deal allows four-year players to become unrestricted. So D'Angelo Williams, that's a guy that I think they still have interest in, even if he has the open market, but I don't think they'll be prepared to pay as much as some other teams will for his services, considering they have Jonathan Stewart, Mike Goodson, Tyrell Sutton, you know, fairly good depth in the backfield even without Williams. Charles Johnson, though, that is a piece that will be very hard to replace. Of course, there will be a deeper pool of free agents now with 4 years being the number. So they could go out and get another guy and maybe not be as good a guy as Charles Johnson. So it would be a tough loss. He really broke out last year. And Ron Rivera needs pressure from up front on that defensive line. He can bring it, and there aren't many other options there that can do it for them.
And just to clarify what we expect to happen, we believe there will be unrestricted free agency after 4 years. We believe there will still be a franchise tag, maybe even a transition tag, but these tenders that were put on fourth, fifth, sixth-year players will be meaningless. Only third-year players will you be allowed to tender. They'll be restricted, and then there's another classification for them. So another one of your clubs, the Atlanta Falcons, everybody thinks the Falcons sitting pretty, number one seed last year, disappointing in the playoffs, but young and getting better this year, and yet three-fifths of their offensive line, and arguably their three best offensive linemen, Justin Blaylock and Harvey Dahl and Tyson Claypool, all would be unrestricted. I guess Claypool will be regardless, but if three of them are, Falcons could have a serious problem.
Absolutely. It's something that probably hasn't been talked about enough this offseason, but if you lose three-fifths of your line, that puts you in a tough spot. Now, the Falcons have been preparing. They've been spending some middle-round picks on offensive linemen over the past couple of years. They have some younger guys that could slide in, but certainly that could be a drop-off, and when you're trying to protect someone that makes as much money and is as valuable to your team as Matt Ryan is, that's a concern. So it's interesting. The talk has been the Falcons going out and addressing a defense in free agency, maybe going out and getting Ray Edwards from the Vikings, who will be out there now if this does come to fruition. They're going to have to look at that offensive line, too, and it's not going to be cheap to keep those players.
Wilkie, you had an interesting piece I noticed the other day on the Baltimore Ravens' Ed Reed. Now, whether this guy is a Hall of Famer or not, I can't say for sure, but he's probably close, and I suspect he is. Says he wants to play to 35. He's 33 now. He's been injury-plagued the last couple of years, and acknowledged this past week that even this far into the offseason, he's not 100% yet.
Yeah, Ed Reed's a guy that has missed time each of the last two seasons with injuries. There was a neck injury in 09, a nerve impingement in his neck. Hip surgery and a hip injury kept him out of the first six games of 2010. When he returned, led the NFL in interceptions. He's obviously the key to what they do on the back end of the defense. But he's also a guy that injuries have been a greater concern these last 2 years than they've ever been for him. So it's clear that this is a player that's on the back half of his career. And how much longer he can play and play at an elite level, you know, really remains to be seen, but I don't think there's anybody that doubts Hub that he's not one of the two best safeties in the league still, that is a huge part of what they're doing, and that any loss of Ed Reed from the lineup this season would be devastating. It's just not a great secondary in general, and he's the key to the entire operation.
Dan, let me ask you quickly about one other club of yours, the New Orleans Saints. Their left tackle, Jermon Bushrod, and Roman Harper. You talk about safeties who had career years last year. That'd be Harper. Two more guys who look to be on the free agent market once the dust settles, and the Saints, who appeared to be up and down last year, but a playoff team until they disappointed in Seattle. These would be significant concerns for them, I would think.
I think the Saints will make a strong play to keep Harper around, and I think he wants to be there, so there's a good chance that I think they eventually get something done with him. But the interesting situation really is Bushrod. Left tackle is, you know, obviously a very key position for them. I think he's going to find some interesting deals on the open market. He's not a Pro Bowl player by any means, but he's been solid. He can play, you know, he can protect from the left tackle position, and I think that the Saints' decision will be, do we offer this player a long-term deal, or do we go ahead and move on and go with the younger Charles Brown, who has no experience, who could benefit from another year or two of seasoning. Tough call for them, and it's, again, they have a lot of other questions to answer in free agency, a lot of players coming up with expiring contracts. They're going to have to pick and choose their spots, and left tackle is not one where you want to be tampering with.
All right, Dan, thank you very much. We're going to let you go. Wilkie, you hang on. Lots more Way We Hear It to cover. We take a quick commercial break, and we'll take a look at Ohio State quarterback Terrell Pryor and what his future might be. We are, and we are talking NFL Way We Hear It. Off-season moves, free agency, hot stove league. I know, there's a labor impasse. No free agents getting signed right now. But there's over 600 of them out there, and something's going to happen quick. One thing that has been established this past week, I don't think anybody ever doubted, is that after 4 years, players are going to be unrestricted again. So that's really opened up the market. But one other interesting impact of all this is that there's usually a supplemental draft or the possibility of a supplemental draft in late July or early August. And there is a potentially big-time player who wants to be in it. That would be Ohio State's Terrell Pryor. And, of course, we've heard Drew Rosenhaus's goofy comments about how he's a slam dunk first-round pick. I don't think anybody believes that. But I think most people do believe that he'll go in the first round. A lot of people think the Oakland Raiders would be a likely suspect, and associate editor Eli Cabron covers the Raiders for us, the entire AFC West. And, Eli, you're hearing mixed signals from the Raiders about what their interest in Terrell Pryor might be.
Yeah, they'd like to get a young quarterback there. They're set on Jason Campbell as their starter, but they'd like to get a young backup in there. And Terrell Pryor obviously fits that mold. He's got a strong arm. He's athletic. He's everything that Al Davis likes. The problem is that they've already given up their second-round pick for next year in a trade with the Patriots on draft day, and they gave up their fourth-round pick last year in the trade for Jason Campbell. So they're already down two picks for next year. So sacrificing a third one to get Pryor is kind of risky at this point.
Although you would think if they could get him in the fifth round, which whether Drew Rosenhaus likes it or not is a distinct possibility, at that point they might be tempted to pull the trigger. And how much of the resistance to pulling the trigger is the bad experience with Jamarcus Russell? Because I happen to be a Drew Rosenhaus fan, guys, but when he talks about the character and the drive of guys like Terrell Pryor as a positive, I think he's kind of missing the boat on that one.
Yeah, character has never really been an issue with the Raiders, but like you said, they were burned with Jamarcus Russell. But that was the number one overall pick. I think that they'd be fine risking the fifth-round pick, like you mentioned, to get Pryor if that's what they thought it could take. But there could just be another team out there that might sacrifice something earlier, and then they don't end up with Pryor. But they'd really like to get a young quarterback, and obviously the youngest one available now that the draft is over is probably Pryor.
All right, Eli, hang on a second, because the NFL market closest to Columbus, Ohio, would be Cleveland. They seem to like Colt McCoy, but that's one of Wilkie's teams. And, Mike, Colt McCoy, a really nice prospect coming out of Texas, but certainly not the athlete that this kid is. What are you hearing about the Browns' potential interest in Pryor?
Well, there was a report in the Cleveland Plain Dealer that the Browns will, study, kind of look into Terrell Pryor and do sort of some due diligence on him. Now, the question is, if you take a Terrell Pryor in the supplemental draft, that would mean that one of the veteran quarterbacks on the roster would have to probably go. And the guy that you'd look at would likely be Jake Delhomme, who makes starter money, didn't play all that well last year. The Browns have already re-signed Seneca Wallace. But I think the really interesting thing here is that this is a team led by Mike Holmgren, who's like for drafting quarterbacks and kind of rolling the dice on guys is pretty well known, and they didn't draft the quarterback. So they make sense in terms of the rumor mill of a team that could fit the mold of being interested in Pryor. But I think, like you mentioned, Hub, I think it comes down to when he's on the board. And obviously, the further on you go, I think it probably widens the net of potential candidates for a Terrell Pryor.
Eli, let's talk about the Kansas City Chiefs. They've got one of the best interior linemen in the league over the last 10, 12 years, a former Pro Bowler, Brian Waters. And yet you're hearing rumblings that this could be his last season in Kansas City. It's not because he can't play anymore, doesn't play quite at the level he used to. And if Scott Pioli, in fact, is trying to build the Patriots West in Kansas City, that might have some impact on how long Waters can stick around.
Yeah, they selected John Ostomoah out of the University of Illinois last year in the third round, and they really are high on him. And it seems like that this could be Waters' last year in Kansas City because they'd like to get Ostomoah in the starting lineup. Pioli, like you said, comes from New England, and their philosophy was always get rid of the older players while they still had young players that could step up. They did it with Lawyer Malloy in New England and Drew Bledsoe, and now it looks like Brian Waters might be the next person to be that casualty of he's just the veteran, and they're looking to get younger on the offensive line.
All right, Eli, very quickly, if franchise tags do still exist, and we suspect they will, is Vincent Jackson a Charger again?
Yeah, it looks like he'll do that unless there's some team out there that's willing to sacrifice two first-rounders for him. But the Chargers franchised him, and he's not happy. He wants a long-term deal, and he probably wants out of San Diego just because they've messed around with him so much on his contract. But if franchise tags are allowed, unless there's a team out there that's willing to spend those two first-round picks on Vincent Jackson, it looks like he'll be catching passes from Phillip Rivers again.
All right, Eli, thank you very much. We're going to let Eli go, but Wilkie hangs on with us as we've got more Pro Football Weekly right around the corner, more Way We Hear It. Lots of talk coming out of the East Could the Bills be on the move? We'll check with Kevin Fishbane in a moment. Pro Football Weekly is back, and we're talking about NFL player movements, the way we hear it, a little bit of free agency. But now I want to welcome in Associate Editor Kevin Fishbane and have a quick conversation about potential franchise movement. You know, Kevin, whenever anybody talks about Los Angeles and the two different stadiums they're trying to build out there, everybody puts five teams in the potential tenant category: San Diego Chargers, LA Raiders, Minnesota Vikings, the St. Louis Rams, and the Jacksonville Jaguars. But suddenly you're hearing that the Buffalo Bills may be late to the party.
Yeah, well, some people wanted to make the assumption that because the Bills were not mentioned by that AEG group that's going to bring a team to L.A., that maybe that's hinting that the Bills maybe are their best choice to bring out there. And you know, from what I'm hearing from people in Buffalo, very familiar with the team out there and their situation, they'd be very surprised if the next owner keeps the team in Buffalo. Ralph Wilson has always said that he's going to sell the team to the highest bidder. He said that he wants the team to stay in Buffalo, you know, when his time has passed, but it's just such a small market out there. I mean, they had to make the agreement with, to have the games in Toronto to get some more money for that team, and, you know, they've expanded out to Rochester. And actually, it's coincidental because their CEO, Russ Brannon, spoke this week about the possible move, and he said they're doing everything they can. They plan to stay in Buffalo, and they're confident what they're doing, but Hub, the one thing lingers, that lease of their stadium ends at the end of 2012. And that's something to really consider for this group in L.A. that wants to own the team that they bring to L.A., not just bring a team over there.
Well, and Wilkie, let me ask you very quickly. One thing we know, the Spanos family, Al Davis, Ziggy Wilf, and then Stan Kroenke, who just bought the Rams, those four, they're not selling their teams. And nobody wants to be the guy who moved the franchise. A new owner can kind of get away with this. And we do know that the Buffalo Bills and the Jacksonville Jaguars are probably going to be for sale as soon as this labor impasse is over.
Those are the teams that obviously, as we mentioned, always get the focus in these type of issues. And yeah, Buffalo is a compelling situation. It's clear that revenue generation is something that's on their mind. And growing that base, the Toronto move was a clear signal along those lines. It's going to be fascinating to see the way this plays out because we know a couple things, guys. First of all, there will be a team in Los Angeles at some point again one day. It's just too big of a market otherwise. And secondly, with regard to any franchise that has an owner that maybe is getting up in age or will maybe declare to sell at some point, there are all sorts of issues in terms of passing a franchise on through the family or deciding to sell and things like that. There are estate tax issues. There are all sorts of things. So there's a lot of moving parts here, it seems like.
Kevin, moving on to one of your other AFC East teams, the New York Jets, you had an interesting conversation with backup quarterback, backup wide receiver, kick returner par excellence, Brad Smith, earlier this week. Now, Smith, in this new deal, assuming that five-year players are unrestricted, will be an unrestricted free agent. Unfortunately, he's not the number two choice at quarterback or wide receiver. He'd be third at best. And so, while he's a wonderful player to have in your ball club, you just have to wonder how much money the Jets are going to have to get keep him there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're talking about a guy who had just a couple catches last year. He did rush for 299 yards out of the Wildcat, and he took two kickoffs back for touchdowns. And, you know, we've seen what it can do, what can spark a team when you have a kickoff returner as electric as Brad Smith, who was averaging over 28 yards a return last season. But Santonio Holmes and Braylon Edwards, those guys obviously come first, and there's no secret about why the Jets drafted Jeremy Curley, a slot-type receiver who also has some return experience. And when I talked to Brad Smith, you know, he said he loves the Jets, but he is going to explore his options. And I've talked to several potential free agents during this kind of limbo that we're in right now at the lockout, and very few of them were as resigned to the fact that they're going to look elsewhere as Brad Smith was. He seems like he wants to stay in New York, and he does love the Jets, but he's, you know, he said it's a business, and he very well understands that he might be playing elsewhere. And a lot of teams could use a guy like that to spark their special teams like Brad Smith.
Well, and Kevin, very quickly, here's the other thing about the Jets. You know, they may be a good veteran ball club ready to contend, but I don't think there's a team out there with more veteran free agents than them. It's not just Smith and Santonio Holmes and Braylon Edwards. They've got a lot of people to sign.
They do. You know, Antonio Cromartie's in there, and you got their kicker and punter, Nick Folk and Steve Weatherford. I mean, that's their whole special teams unit is a free agent. And the other thing they have to consider is they're going to have to put up a lot of money to sign David Harris long term, and they owe Darrell Revis a whole lot of money next season as well. And Mark Sanchez at some point is going to need a new contract. You got young stars like Sean Green coming up, so there's a lot of things for them to consider. And again, they have a host of free agents to deal with once this free agency finally begins.
All right, Kevin, thank you very much. We've got one more commercial break to get in here before we wrap up the way we hear it. Lots left to talk about, though. The Steelers, the Titans, the Jaguars, it's all next in just a moment. Lots more NFL news to give you in Pro Football Weekly. I'm Hub Arkish. Our senior editor, Mike Wilkening, is co-hosting this week, and we are now joined by associate editor Arthur Arkish. And Arthur, AFC South, a lot of guys letting their mouths get them in trouble this week, and I want to start with the Tennessee Titans. Kenny Britt, he may be a wonderful athlete and a great prospect at wide receiver, but you just have to wonder how long this kid's career can go if he can't stay out of his own way. He got in more trouble the last couple of weeks, and now on his Twitter account apparently suggested that he might retire because he'd had enough of Roger Goodell, and that's not the language that he used to explain it that way. He then took that back. He then claimed that his account had been hacked, and he's sticking with that. Well, I don't know if this guy thinks he's a congressman from New York or what the deal is, but the bottom line, it's got to be one of the dumbest kids in the NFL.
Yeah, it's really a bizarre situation. You mentioned he's immensely talented on the football field, but just can't seem to stay out of trouble off the field. This latest Facebook blunder, we'll call it, just occurred earlier this week. And really, it's just kind of symptomatic of what's been going on for this kid all offseason. It's not trouble with the law, but it's really just poor decisions for him to say that his Facebook account was hacked. Like you said, you think he might have learned a lesson from Anthony Weiner. Obviously, he didn't. So the real question is, where does this new regime go from here? What does Mike Munchak do? I'd say it's probably safe to say that the NFL is going to come down with the suspension on Kenny Britt, but the real question, again, is what Mike Munchak decides to do. Now, we talked to our sources in Nashville, and they said that it's no guarantee that Munchak will enforce discipline. Now, we think it could be the right idea. He needs to send a message. We hear that some of his teammates are really wondering how much they can trust Britt, and, you know, sending a message through discipline could be the way to go, but once again, we're hearing that it's not a guarantee. We'll just have to wait and see.
You know, Munchak, one of the all-time great offensive linemen in the NFL, a pretty good offensive line coach, never, however, a coordinator, and a lot of people wondered, is he ready for this? It would be pretty stunning if he didn't do something about this kid, because what kind of message is he sending the rest of his locker room?
No, that's a great point, and again, we suspect the NFL is going to come down with the suspension. We don't know what Munchak's going to do, but again, we're hearing from our sources that at least some people in that locker room do not have the utmost trust in Kenny Britt, and for Munchak not to come through and send a message to him, to this young man, and try and get it straightened out before it gets any worse, really would not be sending the right message.
All right, well, speaking of mercurial wide receivers, Wilkie has a very interesting story this week, and Mike reports that Big Ben Roethlisberger has been in touch with Plaxico Burress on a fairly regular basis since he got out of jail, and that Roethlisberger is letting it be known he'd love to have Plax back in Pittsburgh. Yeah, but would Mike Tomlin? Anything to this story as far as you're concerned?
Well, the interesting thing is obviously, again, Burress, you know, being a guy that's had success in Pittsburgh, the Steelers have shown a, you know, ability to bring guys back and sort of work them back into the mix. Larry Foote, Byron Leftwich, Anton Randall are all guys that came back last year, and filled roles for them. You know, Plaxico Burress is a guy that, you know, if he were to come back, you don't know necessarily if he would figure as a starter for them. But, you know, this is a team that does like to stretch the field, these multi-wide receiver packages, 4 or 5 wide receivers. And, you know, certainly he could still be a guy that could help you in the very least in the red zone. So it was very interesting to see those comments. And, you know, again, where the Steelers come down on this remains to be seen. They are pretty deep at receiver, but I have to tell you, if you add Burress and he can give you anything, and clearly Roethlisberger is on board, as what he told the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, then we have a real interesting story here because, a good offense would be even stronger.
All right, Arthur, Kenny Britt, one of the top performers in the Foot and Mouth Club, Big Ben, he still seems able to dictate what his club might want to do. But now we go to Jacksonville, where MJD is the winner this week. Maurice Jones-Drew, why would he pick now to throw his team and his future quarterback in Blaine Gabbert under the bus? Explain to everybody what I'm talking about.
Well, it really is a bit of a head-scratcher. Just to give a bit of background, back in April when Gabbert was taken with the 10th overall pick by the Jaguars, Maurice Jones-Drew took to his Twitter account to sort of put his faith behind David Garrard. He said David Garrard is our quarterback. He's our guy. Now, earlier this week, Jones-Drew took it a step further and pretty much called out the front office. He said this is not what we needed. What we really needed was an year of continuity with our offense. Again, I don't know who this helps. It certainly doesn't help David Garrard. It doesn't help Maurice Jones-Drew. It puts added pressure on everyone. And he took it a step further. He referenced the New England Patriots, the Indianapolis Colts, the New Orleans Saints as examples of offenses that had continuity at the quarterback position. And I got to say, I don't think anyone's mistaking David Garrard for Tom Brady, Drew Brees, Peyton Manning, except for Maurice Jones-Drew, apparently.
Well, Arthur, you're right on that. And when you're Big Ben, you got two rings and a third appearance, you can try and dictate to the front office. When you're MJD, there's a time to be quiet. We take a quick break. Publisher's Pen is next.
The Publisher's Pen with the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish.
Mike, thank you very much. And, you know, a lot of folks are asking this week, what's going on that suddenly there is so much optimism, so much momentum, that apparently both owners and players have decided it is time to make a deal? And I think I've got the answer for you, folks. When the hearing was held in the 8th Appellate Court about 2 weeks ago, at the end, even though the owners got what they wanted, which is they had a permanent stay on the injunction, allowing them to keep the lockout in place, and they don't have a ruling on the bigger question, the judges said they will take their time and rule in due course. It was Judge Kermit by the dissenting vote, the judge who ruled that the players should be able to get the lockout lifted, who warned before they ended the proceedings, guys, go back and get something done, because if you leave it to us, we're going to give a ruling that neither side is going to like. A lot of people have said, well, what could that ruling be? Either there is a lockout or there isn't a lockout. Well, I think I know what it could be. I think what these judges are going to say is that the players were not allowed to decertify when they did, because in the old collective bargaining agreement it said they had to wait 6 months to decertify if the deal expired, and all they did was race to beat the clock. What if the judges rule that they can't decertify now, but 6 months later they can, and then the players are in the right? Well, that would be September 12th, and that would be the day after the regular season is supposed to start. How would the owners feel about having the lockout lifted with no free agency having been accomplished, no training camps, nothing, a day after the season's supposed to start? That would be anarchy. That would be chaos. That would be a complete mess. And that's why both sides are trying to get something done now. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. Our thanks, as always, to Randy Meyer. Great job engineering, producing. Our home studio and syndicator is Syndication Network. And most of all, our thanks to all of you for listening. We appreciate it so much. Be with us again next week, same time, same station, for Pro Football Weekly.